The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Yeah, good afternoon on this Thursday afternoon. 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. After 4 o'clock, it's our monthly visit of our couple counsellors, Ray O'Neill, who's a psychotherapist, and Alison Keating, who's a psychologist, and they're here to give you free and sort of anonymous advice on any relationship woes you might have. So ray@rte.ie or 51551 for that. And the happy pair are here as well, and if you have any questions for them on living the vegan life, they'll be happy to answer. They're going to be here. But first, this afternoon, a story we spotted by Surika Pollock in the Irish Times today. It's about a Canadian scuba diver called James Kim Martin. And James travelled to Ireland in August to dive the Lusitania shipwrecked off the coast of Cork. And something tragic happened, and poor James has been left paralysed after getting into difficulty while surfacing from the site. His fiancée, Kirsten Chadwick, is now appealing for help to get James home to Canada. And Kirsten is in our Galway studio. Good afternoon, Kirsten.
Hi, Ray.
It's a tough time you're going through. So you're at, is it James or Kim?
It's Kim. James right. is his legal name, but we call him Kim.
Aha. You're at his bedside now for the last how long?
Today is day 50.
Okay, so 7 weeks and this is into your 8th week. And how is James this afternoon?
He's tired, but he is able to communicate a little bit with me. He knows that I'm here, and he wished me luck and gave his blessing for me to tell his story.
Right. So telling his story, he's an accomplished scuba diver, isn't he? How long has he been doing it for?
For over 30 years.
Right.
Yes.
And the Lusitania, was that on a list of things he wanted to do? Or
absolutely. The Lusitania was the last on Kim's bucket list, I suppose, of big dives that he wanted to do.
Was he going to retire from diving after that, or just this was his last big dive?
I don't know if Kim was ever going to retire from diving per se, but this was definitely the last big dive, and it came with, I suppose, a lot of trepidation for us, as we knew it was a big one, and Kim was really looking forward to, I suppose, putting away the sort of training type dives, and so we could just sort of do more leisurely type things.
So in the diving world, something like the Lusitania would be the equivalent of a marathon or ultramarathon or swimming the channel or something like that. So you have to put a lot of prep into it.
Absolutely, yes.
That makes it more sad, doesn't it? More tragic that he had done all these big dives over the years, and it was the last one that this happened on.
Yeah, the last of his bucket list, and I just hope he knows that myself and the whole dive community are so proud of him, and that it was a successful dive.
And he's well known in the diving community, Kirsten. I just see here that he won a Canadian Bravery Medal back in the 90s for saving one of his fellow divers.
Yes, sir, he did.
Yeah. How long do you know Kim?
I've known Kim for a very long time, really majority of my life, and we've been together for the last 2 years.
Right, and I mentioned that you're his fiancée.
Yes.
When are you to get married?
We were actually due to get married on the 24th of August, so Kim was going to be returning from Ireland on August 15th, and we had planned sort of a surprise ceremony and celebration just in our backyard.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find out about the accident?
Yeah, where Kim and I live is a rural area, and so when in the off season, I would live probably 15 minutes from my nearest neighbor. I woke up the morning of the dive expecting a text message from Kim to let me know he had gotten back to the boat safely. And when I did not hear from him, I started to worry. And I knew all of the times of the dive, how long the boat would take, how long the decompression would take, etc. And I knew that if I hadn't heard from Kim by 10:30 a.m. in Canada, that something had gone wrong, at least with one of the divers. 10:15, I didn't hear from him. Phoned my dad, just said, oh, would you take my mind off things? Tell me something, distract me. And when I ran my dad through all of the timing, He said, maybe something happened to the boat. And in that moment, I knew my dad knew something wasn't right. So I hung up with him immediately. I didn't even say goodbye. And I Googled Lusitania, Ireland divers. And it popped up 16 minutes ago in the Irish Times, man airlifted. And that's when how I found out.
But it didn't name Kim in the article, did it?
No, it did not. I guess I'd had a feeling. I never really believed in those sorts of things before. And I had a really awful feeling that morning. And that built throughout the morning as I hadn't heard from him. And when I saw that a man was airlifted, I had a feeling. So I immediately phoned the embassy. It's interesting how you just this intuition or this intelligent person came out in me to think I'm going to phone the embassy, as I knew I had no contact there. And when I phoned the embassy, it had just come in. They said, we're just receiving the news. So it's a Canadian. Can you confirm it's a Canadian? And the woman said, I can confirm it's a Canadian. We don't have a name. No. And I hung up and I immediately phoned Galway University Hospital, as the article had listed. That's the second hospital he was airlifted to. I was put on a lengthy hold and I ended up hanging up phoning Cork University Hospital, and who at first said they couldn't release that information to me. And I was quite distraught and said, please, pleaded with the lovely lady on the phone, who then said, yes, she could confirm that James was in their care.
And you were you on your own then?
I was.
Oh, you poor thing.
Yeah, so that was definitely, you know, the most difficult part of the whole journey was when I found out, and being alone. And I had texted my neighbor, in fact, when I was on hold with Galway before being on hold with Cork, and said, you need to come here now, because I knew that either way, once the Canadian embassy had confirmed, I knew it was either Kim or one of our really close friends. So it was either one of his other two dive partners, who one had just had a baby a year prior, and the other was one of Kim's oldest friends. So I knew in that moment that we had a tragedy on our hands.
And just to explain to people, so the Lusitania is off the Cork coast, so he would have been brought to Cork Hospital, but they have a hyperbaric chamber in the hospital in Galway, and that's why he was brought there. It's the only one in the country.
That's correct. And we are so grateful and blessed to all of the staff at Galway University Hospital and to the doctors and the staff who took, some of them even took time off their annual leave to come and care for Kim, which saved us a longer journey to the UK, in which we don't know if he would have made it.
Hmm. So you then made immediate arrangements to get over and be by his side.
Yes, I think I really, yes, I immediately, the first person that I phoned actually was my boss, and I explained the situation to him, and he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, what do you think I should do? And he said, do you want to go? I said, of course I want to go. And he said, you need to go. And my neighbor had arrived at that time, and we had already gotten in touch with the receiving doctor in Galway and had confirmed a couple of details of the case for us, that Kim was on life support, and that he was, you know, that they were worried about being permanently paralyzed, but that he had no feeling below the nipple when he arrived. And so at that time, I looked at my neighbor, who was already on the phone with her husband, and they were already ready to book a flight for me, they knew.
And then traveling on your own as well, that's a long flight, and you're going every which way in your head, aren't you?
You know, I really, once I got the call from the doctor, you know, and he had confirmed for me, it was very unlikely that he didn't expect Kim to survive just because of the depth that he had surfaced from. So on my way over there, I was really hanging on to this idea that I could see him, that he could at least make it through my journey over there.
So see him before he died, that was...
Yeah, correct.
So they had said that they didn't hold out much hope.
That's correct. And when I had arrived, at 12:30 p.m. on the 9th of August in Ireland. That's when I arrived at the hospital. The doctor and one of the head nurses took me into a room and explained that they were going to take him again to the chambers. It's for the second trip to the chambers the next day. And that it was a high-risk transfer, and there was a chance that Kim wouldn't come back from the chambers, so that they were going to take me in to see him, and that I only had a few moments, but they needed to take the opportunity while he was stable to transfer him to the chambers. So I went in sort of with the mindset that it might be the last moment that I had with him. And after that chamber trip, I was taken in to see him again. And that's when one of the nurses told me, you know, she'd never seen a man so sick on so much noradrenaline, and that he wasn't going to make it through the night, that this was not, that she didn't want to set up any hopes for me. And they had really talked me through the idea that, you know, they'd done everything for Kim, and did I want a priest to come, and really we were talking worst case scenario. And during that night, I turned to one of the nurses, and he'll know who I'm talking about if he's listening to this. And I said, "Have you ever seen a miracle?" And he said to me, "I don't know if I'd call it a miracle, but I've seen people leave this hospital who shouldn't have come out of here alive." And I said to him, "That's a miracle. I need a miracle." And it was the first moment where I really prayed that we could have a miracle. And then the next day the sun rose, and I told every staff member that came in there that Kim was a miracle.
Because they were surprised that he had survived, because I think that there's no other example of somebody coming through what Kim has come through.
That's correct. In the international medical community, for treating divers, it's Kim is the only medically recorded case surviving from that depth and surviving a helicopter ride to a chamber.
What do you think happened? Or has Kim got that amount of communication now that he could tell you? What do you know? Have you any idea what happened? What went wrong?
I haven't really gone into that too much specifically with Kim, but I've talked at length with the other divers. I always say to everybody who asks that question that only Kim can tell us. And right now at his bedside, I want to be his fiance, and so if he wants to talk about it, that I'm there to listen. But I haven't explicitly asked him that. However, from the conversations with all of the rest of the divers and the crew on board that day, we can conclude that Kim was likely inadequately weighted for the dive. So the divers are weighted so that they're able to, so that they don't, to avoid surfacing too quickly on decompressions. And Kim was not weighted, didn't have enough weight with him.
So to sort of a person who doesn't know much about scuba diving, he came up too fast. Is that?
That's correct.
Right.
And that's likely due to not having enough weight. However, there could have been a medical emergency, an equipment failure, or in this instance, if it is not being weighted correctly, that would be human error that would have caused the surfacing.
Right. And the prognosis now, it like from a position, I'm trying to get my head around what you must have been feeling from a position of thinking that the man you love, who you intended to marry, was going to die, and then 12 hours later finding out that he didn't die and he was going to live. How does that affect you?
So interesting, because I think a lot of people assume that I'm really struggling and that I'm going through a really hard time, and it's such a unique feeling, because when you have that moment and you're anticipating the worst day of your life and that day doesn't come, it becomes the best day of your life. And so the last 50 days, I feel so blessed to have him here with us. And I feel like we've been given a second chance at life. And so I know it's come at Kim's greatest sacrifice. And right now, maybe he wouldn't feel the same, but I tell him every day how lucky we are and how blessed we are to have this chance. And really, it's just about how nothing else matters. And all of a sudden, all my worries go away. I'm not worried about a job or how successful I am, because life isn't measured by that. It's about, I tell everyone, it's about growing old and eating Cheetos on the couch together. So if Kim can come home and we can eat Cheetos, then we have everything. And on Monday, he celebrated his 56th birthday in hospital. And I, you know, it's the best, worst birthday you could have, I say.
Yeah.
And on his card, I said to him, today, this gift is symbolic of the rest of our life, because it's not about what you have, it's about who you have. And Kim is so lucky to have such amazing friends and family. And
you.
Yeah, we're so blessed to be together that I really believe that this is, it's something positive. It is almost the best thing that's ever happened to me, because if not, I would still be caught up in things that don't really matter. I think Kim and I are now able to really focus on each other and what really matters in life.
That's beautiful. You on a sort of a practical level, you want to get yourself and Kim back to Canada.
Yes.
Because there you can be surrounded by the people who love you, your friends and extended family and all that. I know from past experience that it will need to be an air ambulance, won't it?
That's correct.
And they're not cheap.
No.
No. So how much are we talking to get an air ambulance to bring Kim back to Canada?
So if I'm to organize the repatriation and it's solely a private repatriation, and I were to say, okay, come pick us up tomorrow, the quotes that I've gotten have been, you know, 80 to 90,000 Canadian or Euro, really depends on the company that you've looked, that I've looked at. However, I am working with a Canadian charity that organizes more of the logistics, and they've put me on what's called a standby list. So if there is a air ambulance that is taking a patient back to Europe, they would be able to pick us up and take us
on the return trip.
Correct.
Yes, yeah.
But it that's still a cost of around $40,000 Canadian.
So you split the cost.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And what about the Canadian authorities, Canadian embassy? Where do they fit into all of this?
Yeah. Yes. Unfortunately, and you know, part of me has to really understand, but really the Canadian embassy has, they have to, I suppose, take the approach that they are only there to support us in the way that they'd be able to support us if we were back home, in so much as they can find us a receiving doctor, or they could help organize the logistics, but they, from a financial standpoint, they're unable to. I've reached out to MPs. I've gone on Instagram, Justin Trudeau's wife. I've really tried everything. Just to get the message out, because for me, I think Kim is a Canadian hero and he has the Medal of Bravery. And I think, I would hope that we would have had a little bit more support, but I'm also very understanding of the political type.
And I suppose that, you know, setting precedents and that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
So there is a GoFundMe page.
Yes.
Which, if people go, Kim Martin's Road to Recovery, Save a Hero's Life, is the, people can find that on GoFundMe. What's the prognosis, Kirsten?
Yes. Kim is going to have life-altering spinal cord injury. Right now, we're hopeful that he will build the strength in his hands and in his upper body enough to, you know, improve his life in that way. However, he is paralyzed.
He's a different man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I told everybody when I spoke to them originally, I said the Kim and Kirsten that left Canada, both of those people are never coming home.
Right. And what about the wedding?
Yes. The first night I was here, I kept thinking, well, maybe we can get married in the hospital, but I guess the nurses have have convinced me that that probably wouldn't be the most romantic or memorable moment for us. So I'm really hopeful that when Kim and I return and after he's done some rehab, that we'll be able to still have a nice private ceremony. Ideally, I'm hopeful that my goal is to have Kim be able to live independently or semi-independently. And that would be lovely to be able to have a backyard and still get married in the backyard.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he didn't have insurance, and that's why we're talking to you. Well, we would have talked to you anyway, but that's part of the reason. Heartbreaking story. I'm a diver, and this is every dive trip's nightmare. It's a dangerous activity, isn't it? It is, and you would have talked to Kim about that, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. We would have talked. It's almost surreal that this is happening, because it is something that we had talked about and at great length, and I knew the exact hospital that, you know, Kim would have been taken to, or that somebody would have been taken to, and it was almost a morbid type joke. Oh, ha ha ha! When so and so,
oh, you'll end up in that.
This is where we'll be going.
Yeah.
And so we definitely knew the risks, and as a
I suppose PLC. I'm not saying it's an obsession, but his love of scuba diving was part of the reason you loved him so much, I would imagine, because it made him who he was.
I think just the tenacity at which Kim did anything. If he put his mind to something, he was going to accomplish that. And absolutely, I think whenever we were at home, so many people would say, oh, it's so cool, it's so cool. And I remember actually the night before the dive at hanging out with some of my girlfriends, and they said, oh, it's so cool. I said, actually, it's just brave, and it's something that's important to him. Mm. So I never really saw that in it, I suppose, because I knew how risky it was.
And you never tried to dissuade him?
No, never.
No.
I always wanted to encourage Kim, because I think that even more remarkable than diving is the fact that there are so few people who dare to dream as big as he did, or dare to dream at all. And even for myself, I think of the dreams goals I've ever set out for myself, and it takes a lot of bravery to step up and do whatever it takes to achieve them. Mm. I think so few people in the world are brave enough to say out loud, this is what I want, and then to go out and achieve them is just one step more. I think that's truly what I loved. It wasn't the diving. It was that here's this person willing enough to be brave and say, I'm willing to dream big and I'm going to go after it.
And he's going to have to draw on that tenacity, isn't he, in his recovery?
Absolutely. I hope everybody keeps saying that Kim has to be happy with the person that comes home. And that's hard to hear, because Kim isn't his body, Kim is his mind. And I know we're bringing that mind home. So this person will continue to inspire me and be my biggest hero and the biggest source of strength in my life. So I'm so excited to bring him home and just continue to be proud of him every step of the way and be the person. I'm so honored to be by his side.
Oh, Kirsten, I'd love to give you a big hug. And the people of Galway have been very kind to you.
Oh,
I know.
Goodness me. Yes, they have. I'm so grateful that this happened here in Ireland, because the Irish people have been more than remarkable to me. My first night, a woman must have overheard me telling the nurses, I forgot socks. Kim will be so mad at me. I forgot to pack my socks. I'm so irresponsible. And this lovely woman went out and bought me some socks. And every step of the way, whether it's families who've driven me to the bus station or taken me out to Supermax and said, you know, just something just like, you know, to be normal and just to be able to laugh and, you know, see their strength as well and be so supportive, offer up their houses for me to stay overnight if I ever need it, sharing our GoFundMe page. I'm forever going to be indebted to the Irish people and the staff at Galway University Hospital. Both Kim and I will never forget what everybody's done for us.
Somebody's just pointed out there, Kirsten, there's an Irishman called Mark Pollock, and he's doing amazing work around spinal injury and rehab, and he's back on his feet in an exoskeletal suit. Now, it's a bit down the line, for Kim, but it's something you should look into. It'll give you hope. And somebody else saying, imagine if 80,000 Irish people donated just €1 each. Such a heartbreaking story. So we've put the details of your GoFundMe page up on our website, Kirsten. Kim Martin's Road to Recovery, Save a Hero's Life. Mind yourself, and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you so much, Ray.
To see how you get on.
And yes. I just want to take this opportunity to thank all of our friends and family at home, the people of the university, and everybody who supported us along the way, and the Dive community. You are like our family, and we wouldn't be able to do this without you guys.
Mind yourself, Kirsten.
Thanks, Ray. Mind
yourself. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Your guest, Kirsten, is a most humble, brave, loyal, fearless advocate on behalf of her partner, Kim, says John Corkin, Bishop down in Cork. She is an amazing woman. And we have another amazing woman in studio with us now, Bridie Sweeney, a well-known name out in Talla in West Dublin. She's been the Talla Person of the Year twice, and she's been Lord Mayor of Talla twice. And now, Bridie, do you mind sharing your age with us?
Good afternoon, Ray.
Good afternoon, Bridie. What age are you?
I will be 88 tomorrow.
Happy birthday to you. That's why we brought you in. Your birthday.
No. Thank you.
We spotted you in the paper the other day.
Yeah.
And it's Active Ageing Week.
That's right.
And you're 88 and you're very active.
Yes. Yeah. Thank God. Yeah.
Wouldn't Kirsten and her story of herself and Kim give you hope? And it gives you perspective as well, doesn't it?
It does.
Yes,
it does. And like I would go back 50 years when Trustus over Talla Welfare at the time, and we had nothing really in Talla all those years ago. And Father Paul Hines from our Talla Priory and Charlie O'Toole, Breadman, they set up Talla Welfare Society. And out of that came the need for a day centre for people to go and have a cup of tea and a chat. And we were in a room in Dr. O'Riordan's house in the village for a couple of years. And then we were breaking at the seams. There was no room for all the people that wanted to come. And we got Glenview Lodge Daycare Centre. And we all moved in there. And I was manager of that for 30 years.
And you've seen huge changes in Talla
in those
50 years.
Oh, yes. Definitely. A lot of changes.
Because it went from a village, as you say,
yes,
to a population of over 80,000.
Yeah. Well, they say of those times, and I knew the two of them, there was a pub at the top of the village. It's the Dragon now. But at that time, two sisters owned it. And they would be there serving that little beer in that jogging all during the day. And there'd be nobody in Talla. But if you came into it and walked down the village, there'd be an SOS out, and the few in the village would be got together to know who were you.
Oh, yes, because you're a stranger.
What are you doing? Yeah. And all that is what it was like.
And there'd be tractors and horses and carts and all that sort of thing, because it was out in the country nearly.
Out in the country, yes.
They're all listening out in Talla today, are they?
Yes, they are. They're up in the club listening, they're in the Vincent de Paul place listening, and everyone, especially when quarter to two came and Joe Duffy came on.
Yeah.
And I heard you saying, I'm going to...
Oh, yes.
Right. And I said, well, God, now
it's
everyone...
It's real now. No going back. He said it. It must happen.
Yeah. But Active Age started with me. I would know Active Age, how to be working with Active Age from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Because we used to have a week in the centre. We would have 1 week that was every year set aside for it, and Father Ben or Father Pat Lucy would come over from St. Angus's Church, and we would start that week with a mass in the centre, and then all the other people around, because there wasn't that many help and there was nothing going on at that time, only our place, and we would have different things organised. They'd be bringing us to the Cuckoo's Nest and bringing us up to Malaya's and bringing us to the embankment, and we
You're hugely active still, so tell us your week. What do you do in a week?
In a week I go to my club. There's a lovely social club, Kiltipper Club, and I'm in that since it started over 20 something years ago. And I go to that a couple of times a week. And in that, there's aerobics. I do half hour sitting aerobics with these instructors. And then when the half hour is up on the chairs, we put them back. And another lady comes in and we do a half hour standing.
Aerobics.
Right, yeah. And then when she's gone, there's another lady comes in and we all learned line dancing.
Right.
We learned that with Kitty over the years. She's retired now. And then we would do, I would know about maybe 10. The Galway girl would be the last one I learned. So they would go through so many and then I have to leave because I am...
You're tired?
No, I'm not. I'm going to work now, you see. I'm going down now to the Vincent de Paul shop in the village at 1:00 and I work there till 5:30.
How many days a week?
Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Sunday.
Right. And the line dancing, this is, we talked to Jim McManus a few weeks ago and I've read about this and I've watched documentaries. Dancing is amazing for you.
Yeah. It's great.
What is it about it?
It is. I don't know, but I love it.
It makes you smile, obviously. And
yeah. But we're all on the floor. Like a lot of them, no, I won't say a lot of them are my age. They mightn't like me saying that. But last week we celebrated my friend. She was 90.
Right.
You know, and like her and I would dance on the floor side by side. You know that way?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I do like, always liked to be doing something because my husband died 30 years ago and
for he was a young man then, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yeah.
What age was he?
62.
62,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And I found it hard then and I had 4 children and I used to go with my bag from one house to another at night, you know. And then
you'd be scared, it was scared, was it?
Well, it was new to me what was going to happen.
Yeah, so you wanted company and all
yes,
that.
Yes, and then one morning I was coming home and I just... God, I always say it's Our Lady that helped me. And she said, now, you know, this is your life now, so you've got to make another way of living. And I told them, and they didn't like it. They wanted to be coming and coming. So I said, no, just leave me. I've got to do my way. And I started off being there, and I started off getting involved in things. You must have something to do with every day.
Yeah.
You must be involved. There's so many, so many clubs and organisations, so many people needing you that there's no
social
need.
Social interaction is hugely important as well.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Because you're out there, you're in the Vincent de Paul, you're doing your aerobics, your line dancing, you're sitting, you're standing.
Yeah.
And you do something else as well, do you? What else do you do in the week?
I don't want to be saying all I do. I don't. I'm a Eucharistic minister in Tala Hospital.
Right.
Only Father John said last week, we were having a meeting and he said, there was about 100 of us, and he said, I'm just going to mention one person because she's 21 years since the hospital opened.
Yeah. Is it 21 years since Tala Hospital opened?
Yes, and I'm there and I work there with my friend Rose, and then her and I do Kiltippa Woods every couple of Sundays. Give Holy Communion.
Oh, sorry,
to all the people.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm in the conference of St. Martin de Porres up in my parish church, and we meet there, another 8 of us, separate 8, and we go out around the parish every Wednesday night helping people that need help.
And the church is so important for people of your generation.
Oh yes,
isn't it?
Oh, very important. Yeah. I go to 9:30 mass every Sunday. I never miss mass. And at that mass, there's friends that I have met all through the years, and I'm a Eucharistic minister there, and they're all around me. Like I've lovely friends, I've lovely family, I've lovely neighbours.
Who's in the family?
I have 4 children. I had 5. The 3rd little boy died. I have 2 sons. My eldest son is 66 next month. He's going to get the pension.
How do you feel about that?
And then I have my other son. He's 65. And
right.
Then I have 2 girls. Mary will be 60 soon. And her sister is 57.
Right.
Yeah.
And then grandchildren.
I have 10 grandchildren. And I have 15 great grandchildren with 2 more on the way.
That'll
be 17 I'll have by Christmas.
Yeah. Is that a big day for you that your son is getting the free travel?
No, it's just his way of life. The highlight of the year, maybe this year, was 2 of my great grandchildren made their first communion.
Right.
And my granddaughter is in London. She set up home and lives there with her 2 sons. And they invited me over and brought me over, and I was Eucharistic minister in the church with
in
the
London.
Irish priest.
Right.
Yeah, with about 200 children. And that was over there. And then here in Kingswood in Tala, my grandson, his son made it. And I was there Eucharistic at that. So all that is what...
I doubt that... Do you ever get lonely?
No. I've never been lonely.
No,
because I can pray. I'm a good prayer. People would say to me, will you pray for such and such and tell? I can pray. And at night, I can watch the programmes as I watch it. Yeah. And I watch Ryan Turbury. And anything that I want to see, I'll get the paper. I get the Herald every evening. I wouldn't go home without it. And I can read that when I go up into my room. I can read that.
And then you watch a bit of telly.
And then I watch telly,
I do.
And when you're asking questions, I always know the answer.
Do you never win?
But I never win.
I've no clout on that
one. I know. And
Friday.
Did I tell you, one night I went to sleep in between and didn't I dream?
Oh, that you won?
That I won.
Let's see who's won our competition tonight. Hello, Bridie and Tala. Right, I'd just like to tell you, you're €15,000 the richer. That's the way the dream went, something like that. That's brilliant.
That's just the way it is.
Well, you're very welcome to come into the TV show.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and bring some of your friends in.
Yeah, to be all listening now. Many will I bring?
You're all very welcome. I don't want to put a cap on it, I don't want to give a number. But you're all very welcome, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
What advice, because a lot of my wife says to me, you know, once you start thinking you're old, that's the beginning of the end.
See, I never think that way. I mean, my birthday would go if friends and family
didn't recognise it.
I would never say I'm 30 next week or 80 next week. I don't live that
way. What age do you feel?
I just don't feel any different than I did. I mean, in Trust Us now, where we started, we're 50 birthday and we're all in the Maldon tomorrow night.
So you started there at 38?
I started there, yeah.
And what work do you do there?
I used to run the daycare centre, Glenview Lodge, daycare. And I've done that for 37 or 8 year voluntary. And, you know, it's easy. You must be motivated. You must have something to get up for.
Yeah.
You must have something to do. I wouldn't just sit at home and do nothing. I couldn't do that. Have to be going somewhere, doing something.
Because there has to be meaning to it.
Yes.
And volunteering gives life meaning.
Even today now, a woman from the radio yesterday, and a woman said to me, rang me, and she said, could I talk to you, she said, and get a bit of advice, I know you, and she said, the way you're going around, she said, you're so happy. Could you tell me, because I'm not that kind of person.
Right. What did you say to her?
I said, yeah, anytime.
Right, but what advice would you give her, do you think?
What will I tell her? I'll tell her to get involved. Don't sit at home. I've seen some of my friends, and they're not able to get out now. And if they had kept out. You must go.
It's hugely important. Social interaction is very important.
It is very.
And dancing.
I recommend that.
Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Bridie. And we'll see you when you come into the TV show.
Thank you very much indeed.
And happy birthday tomorrow.
Thank you.
Bridie Sweeney, 88 tomorrow. Happy birthday to you. I can't sing, Bridie, so I won't subject you to that. Thanks, Bridie. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Happy pair, boys. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ray.
David, how are you? Stephen, good to see you.
Ray, very good.
Flynn, boys. We've had two very strong women on since 3 o'clock, so now we've two very strong men.
Thank you, Ray.
You still look very, very fit. So you're still doing everything, are
you? While we were waiting there, we hadn't really trained all day, so it was like, let's just see if we can do 100 press-ups before we even come in here.
But I literally just coming down.
We
just got 100. Yeah, it was nice.
Because remember that program's Lazy Town?
No.
Right, there was a kids' programme called Lazy Town, and there was a guy, the main guy was Sportacus, but I can't remember the actor's name, but he used to be an aerobics instructor in Iceland, right? And he started his thing going around to schools, and we'll talk to you about going around to schools in a moment, and he thought that, well, there's a market here for a programme that promotes healthy eating and exercise. So he came up with this idea of Lazy Town, but he was the star. But he did all his own stunts. But I remember we spoke to him years ago on the radio, and he had travelled from Iceland or England or someplace like that. His flight was delayed, and this is going to trump you. He did 200 straddle jumps in the airport.
Straddle jumps?
So he was able to go from a standing position up and hit his toes.
Jeez, that's a straight leg. For your listeners, straddle jump is so hard to do. Even two of them, you're hurting.
Even on a trampoline, it's wow. hard to do. He was doing them from scratch.
Wow, he sounds like an athlete, a real athlete.
So you've done 100?
Yeah, we were just doing something to give us energy. And, you know, we've had
where did you do the 100 press-ups?
In the car park.
Did you?
And even in the waiting room, the poor receptionist didn't know what was happening. It turned into a little gym, but it's great fun.
So that's what you do in your moment, you just do something.
Well, I think always, like, just to keep energy. Like, we were going around to schools there the last 2 weeks, and yes. one of the big things we talked about was movement. And, like, movement, we forget that we're mammals and our primary fuel source is actually oxygen. And when you move more, you get more oxygen, more blood flow around your body, and you generally feel better. So,
yes.
So we were feeling a bit tired. I was like, right, I haven't trained today. Right, let's see if we can do 100 press ups before we.
See, this is the thing. And people would listen to that and they say, that's counterintuitive. Because you said, I felt tired. Yeah, and absolutely. Then you to go and do 100 press ups.
But through doing it, you look stupid, you feel ridiculous. But afterwards, you feel great. And you go, wasn't that great? And I suddenly feel alive. And it's like, oh, great. And then what happens afterwards is you turn to water. Whereas what you might have, like, a lot of people might turn to coffee or chocolate bars or I need an energy drink or whatever.
They all do.
Whereas if you do press ups like, or something like that, some more movement, you typically turn to water afterwards and then you forgot what you were craving before.
Yeah. So, I don't know if I could do 100 press-ups.
Well, even 50 or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I could probably do 50.
Well, you do 10. Like, you do 10, just do and then you take break to 10. Yeah, you know, baby steps.
Yeah. Big news for you, your ever-expanding empire, vegan empire. Sounds like something from a sci-fi movie.
It really does, doesn't it? Zombie apocalypse. They're coming.
So you've opened a cafe out in Dublin Airport.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think it's open 2.5 weeks now.
Right.
It took about 2 years kind of working on in the background. And you know the way you're working on something and you forget that it's a big deal. And it's only when you put it up in social media, you put it out there, it's like, wow, I didn't realise that was such a... Because you're just caught in the moment. But I guess we're honoured in that it's one of the first in the world in an airport that's plant-based and it's using all compostable packaging. So it's pretty cool. We're really excited and proud and delighted.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose, like, not to be too up its own behind, but it does send out a message. If you're coming into Dublin Airport and you see a vegan restaurant, it says something about the country you're coming into, does it not?
I think it probably caters to... You know, there's an offering there for people that would be that way.
Yeah, I think it's I think
particularly when you travel, like healthy eating, people try to, you know, because there's a lot of sitting and it can be difficult. And I think having healthier options is something that we look for all the time anyway.
Yeah. So right. Great. Well, good luck with that.
Thanks.
Yeah,
we're chuffed. We're delighted with it. It's once you go through. It's once you go through the airport. So it's airside.
Terminal 2.
Near Starbucks.
Terminal 2. Yeah.
Okay.
Terminal 1. Sorry.
Terminal 1. Yeah.
I have to tell you.
Now I was talking to somebody upstairs and saying I'm very hungry this week, and I was suggesting that maybe it's the temperature change, that it's getting a little bit colder, so we need more food.
I want more starch and more carbohydrate.
Yeah. And people's diets do change, don't they, from summer to winter?
Typically. Even you look at the seasons, like right now it's autumn, so suddenly it's more root veg, it's more carrots, there's leeks, there's blackberries in the bushes, it's apple season, it's pear season.
And then there's more of a yearning for warmer, comforting things, like porridge is much more appetizing now than it is when it was 25 degrees or whatever in the morning.
Even soup. Soup weather is kicking off and lentils, nothing like a bowl of lentil soup.
What soup? What's your favourite soup at the moment?
Just something hearty. I just love soup. I love in general as well, but lentils themselves, I always find it just like a belly hug, like something like a nice country dal or something like a Spanish lentejas, which is like a kind of Spanish peasant food, which is just you cook kind of whole lentils with kind of tamari and lots of root vegetables, probably takes 50 minutes and it's so hearty. It feels like you're just being so kind to yourself eating it.
That's a good sales pitch.
It is. I just love that. I find it like giving me a hug on a warm day, like it's that kind of thing, or a cold day.
The man in the local supermarket was telling me that he can't keep vegan stuff on the shelves. Now that's a big term, because like anything from a raspberry,
a carrot. Them vegan carrots are flying out.
A chocolate bar, crisps.
But I was just thinking that probably when it comes to people who, and I'd imagine that their parents listening, grandparents listening, and their children have come home and decided for whatever reason that they're going to go vegan. And that's a challenge for them, and particularly school's back in. So what do you give them for lunch, for example?
Yeah, I think that's... And I think the big thing message that we... And we were just back off a school tour where we talked about 20 different schools. And I think the main message for anyone listening, it's not really about vegan. It's about eating more whole foods. Because I could eat a vegan diet and eat nothing but dark chocolate, bag of crisps and French fries. And I'm not really healthy. I'm vegan.
Right.
Whereas the main message for health is to try to eat more fruit and veg. Because 9 out of 10 Irish people don't get enough fibre. And fibre is really important.
Like what we were saying in all the kids, we were saying, fibre! Really important.
Do they know what fibre is? Do they understand what fibre is?
I hope they do now. Yeah, I think the ones that we went to, I think definitely do. But it was really like we were drilling home the message of eat more fruit and veg, move more. One of the big things we learned going around the schools was that anxiety is very prevalent. So we did quite a lot of breath work with the kids as well, which was really fun. It was really interesting.
And did you do your handstand? That'll get their attention.
In our last school, we were in Artane in St. David's School, and there was a teacher, Sean, and he managed to get six of the kids to hold a handstand for as long as they could, combined them, and to see if me and Dave could hold ours for longer.
To
be a great crack, and all the kids were counting. It was really, really fun.
Yeah, really good crack.
What sort of questions were they asking you?
Oh, hilarious. From what's your middle name? What's your favourite pet?
Okay.
Which one's older?
What's your favourite colour?
Like we went to a combination of primary schools and secondary schools, and the primary schools, it was much more like swallowing swords, not literally, but it was more, you had to put on a show and it was good crack. But with the secondary schools, you could talk more rich content and kind of talk about, like, one message which we kept kind of saying to second level students was just about embracing failure, that like one of the things that helped us in terms of business was actually making mistakes, because it helped you learn more and help get better, whereas in school it's always
it's not to say to consciously try to make mistakes, but just to be less fearful. And that was the whole thing, because often the fear kind of holds you back.
To increase your success rate, you have to double your failure rate. That's sort of
things sound a bit quintessential, but oh my god, that's the same kind of stuff. But like one of the things which we went in and said was like, which we know in the primary schools, you ask the kids, I want to be an astronaut, I want to play for Manchester United, I want to play for Ireland, and they all believe it. And then you go into the secondary schools and they're all like, there's a different energy.
Oh,
they don't
see.
And they're more afraid to say, you ask them, what does anyone want to be when they're older? And most people just go,
you become more self-conscious, don't you?
Yeah, so we talked about following your dreams, which sounds a bit twee, but we kind of used our own story to say that, hey, we started a vegetable shop, like it wasn't the idea of anyone following their dreams, but hey, that was something which we felt on, and it's kind of grown into a really fun adventure.
There you go. Padraig says, the two lads were in my son's school today. Was it today?
Yeah, we were in Tala. We were in St. Mark's in Tala.
Right.
We were in St. David's in Artane. Great crack. Brilliant school.
So what about lunches then?
Okay, lunches.
For a vegan.
For anyone listening, and again, just to reiterate a thing, I think it's not necessarily about vegan. It's to eat more whole foods.
So I think
rather than eating more white bread, try to choose wholemeal bread. I think fruit, you cannot eat too much fruit, and if you do eat too much fruit, you'll know about it, things are moving a little quick.
Yeah.
So just make sure and brush your teeth.
Yeah. So I think the thing is to try, apples are in season right now, pears are in season, blackberries are in season, try to eat those. Bananas, you know, most seeds are not.
Now, Stephen's gone off on a fruit tangent there, but like this morning I made my kids' lunchbox at 5:30 before we left at 6, and I had wholemeal crackers. I kind of broke them up, nice kind of crunchy crackers. They'd hummus in a little pot, so they dipped the crackers in the hummus.
Yes.
There was cucumbers sliced up. I gave them a couple of these kind of dried fruit kind of things. I gave them a little biscuit, and I gave them some peppers and carrots chopped up, and that was their lunch. So
yeah.
Now my kids are 8 and 6, so
it's all raw.
Crackers. I guess so.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, there was a biscuit and there was a few little kind of dried fruit.
But even dried fruit is sort of, is it raw? Is it?
But isn't that unconsciously trying to give them raw food?
But they say that raw food is great. Like that's because all fruit is.
I think as it gets a little cooler, I'll definitely start making soups and putting them in those little hot boxes, and we'll try to mix it up a little bit because they do get bored. Like sometimes I'll
even wholemeal pasta and things like this is a nice.
Because it for a couple of days, the hummus and the carrot sticks, you know, is lovely. But then you have
the spice of life. We get bored. We used to go to school. We used to get ham and cheese sandwiches on white bread.
Right.
And when the bread was crusty, you used to buy a bag of crisps and put them in the middle. And that was our ideal lunch. But
I was going to say hunger is a great sauce.
Yes.
That if your kids are hungry, they'll eat the food. So I think, you know, like we had the same lunch every day for 18 fucking years. So, you know, I think kids
You know, that was first said in Don Quixote. Hunger is the best sauce. I thought it was granny who said it first.
Yeah, it felt like it was our granny too. She's always said it.
Yeah, but we had Karis Matthews from Catatonia on Saturday night, and she's this lovely book, Where the Cooks Go Wild. I think that's what it's called, Where the Cooks Go Wild. And it's a cookery book, and it's a travel book, and it's all sorts of quotes. You'd love it, actually.
That sounds really nice.
And that's where the hunger is
hunger
the best
is
sauce
the best
comes
sauce.
From.
Totally agree.
So good luck with the new cafe out in Dublin Airport. And you say it's Terminal 1.
It's Terminal 1.
Airside.
Airside. I forgot that word. But you've got a board before you get to
it. And listen, I am going to come and join you for one of
your shows. You promised it last time.
I know. I've been in to see an awful lot this year and I've loved it. Not with you, obviously. But it's warm. Is this that it's warm?
It's still kind of 15 degrees. It's still very pleasant.
We had this great idea swimming today out by Sandy Mount. Walked down for about 2 miles to get there. And, geez, it was about a 2-mile walk. walk to get out to the water, to swim in the water that was up to my knees. But it was great crack. I looked like a lunatic. It was great fun.
So it's about 15 degrees.
Yeah, really nice.
Yeah, for anyone who's listeners interested in swimming in the sea, right now is one of the best times of the year because there's most amount of seaweed in it. So it's really high in iodine, which is good for your blood and good for your health. It's also the warmest.
Because it is accumulated heat throughout the summer.
Yeah, so and if anyone is listening, like, there's so many benefits of swimming in the sea, but if you don't live near the sea, cold showers do the same kind of thing. I know it sounds crazy, but there's loads of medical research that shows that it really brings you back to the present moment and it builds
your immune
system.
Now, there are question marks over some of that. Your man, what's his name?
Wim Hof.
Yeah, there's some question marks over his findings or his claims. But anyway,
that's a great character.
That's another day's work. Steve, good to see you.
Great to see you, Ray. Thank you, Ray. Right. Thanks a million.
Another 100 press ups there. Quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
GoFundMe page. We have the details up on our website there. We spoke to Kirsten at the top of the show. Kim Martin is her fiance's name. So it's Kim Martin's Road to Recovery, Save a Hero's Life. That's the GoFundMe page there. And they're trying to repatriate Kim, who's in the university hospital in Galway. And that's that. And a lot of people have been asking for that. Your last guest, who will be 88 tomorrow, would put most 60-year-olds to shame, let alone 70-year-olds. She's an absolute tonic to listen to. God bless her, says Helen. Can you please say hi to Bridie and best wishes from Alison O'Toole, originally from Tala, living in Castlebarna. We worked in St. Martin's, Vincent de Paul in Old Bawn. Well, she's gone, but I'm sure she's listening in the taxi. And just listen to this wonderful woman. Where does she get the time to sleep? Well done. You're a credit to us all, says Tony in Cork. And we have Ray and Alison coming up in about 10 minutes time. They're our couples counsellors. Ray is a psychotherapist and Alison is a psychologist, and they drop in every month or so to offer you advice on your relationship woes. And if you want their advice today, it's ray@rte.ie. Now, singer Ariana Grande has been spotted around Dublin this week. She performed 3 sold-out shows in the Three Arena, and it turns out the 26-year-old pop star is quite the knitting enthusiast. And we have Kevin Spring on the line, owner of Spring Wools. Afternoon, Kevin.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks. Love to speak to you as well.
Yeah, you're out in Ballymount there.
Yeah, we're in Walkinstown, just beside the Walkinstown roundabout.
Right.
A store here, Spring Wools, wool shop.
And are you the biggest wool shop in Ireland, or one of the biggest?
Oh, we would be the biggest. We're here almost 40 years, so we supply most of the wool shops in Ireland, and then we also export all over the world. We have an online presence with springwools.com. So, we're a busy organisation. We have a retail shop here as well.
Right. So you're retail and wholesale.
Then we have a web presence, so we do the whole gambit.
Okay, so what happened this Monday then?
Well, Monday I got a phone call at 4:30 from an American-voiced lady saying that she was on the way out to see me. She was coming from Paris Court. I immediately assumed it was Paris Court in town. Americans from town, coming from town, from the hotels in town all the time. So I assumed that's where she was coming from. But she said it was going to take an hour, and I said, but you're only in Paris Court. She said, no, I'm in the hotel in Paris Court in Wicklow. So I said, fine, yeah, no problem. She said, will you be here? I said, yeah, I'll be here. I'll stay. Yeah, no problem. So she rang about 3 times from her taxi to say, we're a bit delayed or stuck in traffic. We'll be there shortly. She actually arrived at 5 to 6, so it took her almost an hour and a half to get here.
So she was on the M50, wasn't she?
Exactly the route she would have taken, all right. But she got stuck somewhere, and she arrived in the door here at 5 to 6. This was Monday, by herself. Middle-aged lady, American accent, and she walked around the shop, had a good look, asked a few questions, asked about knitting looms, and said, okay, that's grand, okay, bye, so. And she walked out the door.
Right, and did you ask her any questions?
No, I didn't, because we get Americans here every week, all the time. We get Americans in. Very unusual for an American to walk in the door and not purchase.
Right, and very unusual for a woman to ring from Powers Court Hotel, travel all the way over.
It's normally the Shelbourne or the Fitzwilliam or somewhere in town locally, you know. So it was unusual, and she did go a long way. And the strange thing was that after she left here she came in at 5 to 6, she left at 6:07.
Right.
And she sat in the taxi, it was a taxi this time, she sat in the taxi and she took her mobile out and she started making phone calls and texting, and she came back once or twice and said, is there a Murray's shop around here? And I said, no. Is there a McCarthy shop? And I said, no. And she said, oh, look, they're in New York. They're not here at all. I'm looking at New York. So she stayed sitting in the taxi for 20 minutes and then she drove off. So she spent effectively from 4:30 to 6:30 getting to here.
What sort of woman was she? What way was she dressed?
Okay, that's a good question, because I describe her as somebody as I don't want to be derogatory, but as somebody you wouldn't mess with.
Okay.
She wasn't big, but she looked a bit muscular, all right, you know. So dressed very casually, not right. Formally, not glammed up, but you know, New York street style, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah. And she knew what she was about, that sort of thing.
She had no idea what she was. She knew what she was about.
No, but she knew what she was about. Yeah, but she had an air of confidence about her.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes,
totally. Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Tough cookie.
Okay, right.
So, a bit of a shock. An American spending a taxi fare for, I don't know much, but it cost 100 euro, I suppose, said to get here for an hour and a half and then spend nothing. And anyway, so that was that. And then the next, that was Monday evening. So, Tuesday afternoon, I start getting phone calls. Her name was Diane. This is Diane. Hey, are you there again this evening? I said, yeah. What time are you there at all? I said, so I wasn't going to stay till, you know, all hours. So I just said, I'll be closing at 5:30 this evening. You be there at 5:30? I'll be there at 5:30. So she rang about three times after that. She said, you'll still be there at 5:30? Yes, I'll be here at 5:30. And she rang my son. He was here. He answered the phone. He said, yeah, we'll be here at 5:30. So at about 5:15, she says, yeah, we're here. And I looked outside the door and there was no sign of anybody. I said, what's going on? This is crazy.
Yeah.
5 minutes later, this blackened out sort of minivan pulls up at the door, a guy in a suit driving it, looked very formal. And then the doors opened and a pile of people hopped out, including Ariana Grande.
Ah, and did you know it was Ariana Grande? I can't say her name.
Did I know when she got out, or did I know when she was in the shop?
Either.
The answer is neither.
Neither.
No, right. I didn't. I knew the name. I knew about the bombing thing in the UK and that.
Yeah, Manchester.
Singing some of the songs. Yeah. But in real life, she is quite petite. Now, she came in the door, actually, I was sitting on my desk just inside the reception, and she came in the door and she high-fived me from a distance and says, hi, Kevin, as if she knew me. But right. she just listened to five phone calls in the
yes,
hey,
yes.
Kevin, this Diane, you know, Kevin here. So she basically threw a high-five and went into the shop. And then she said there was another girl about her age, there was two guys, there was the lady who'd been here the previous day, and they started picking up yarns all over the shop. Irish yarn, four plies, Aaron.
Balls of wool.
Oh, yeah, all broad, different qualities, different styles, different types. And then she was asking about Irish wools, because they do a lot of exclusive stuff that you wouldn't find in most stores.
And did she sound knowledgeable on the wool?
She knew what she was looking for. She knew what she was making. She got a lot of embroidery threads as well.
Right.
So for things she'd use for making braids or friendship bracelets, things like that. But she knew exactly what she was looking for. And she was asking questions about the Irish wool and the exclusive stuff we have. And the strange thing was, I said to her, she started packing up all over the place, and I started putting into bags or sacks and so forth, and I said, listen, I can ship this out for you, no problem, I ship it out to the US, you know, we do this all the time, part of our
yes.
plan. I said, oh no, I need this for tonight, I'm using this tonight. And I said, tonight? She says, yeah, I'm making scarves, you know, so away with you, grand. A lot of yarn, she spent, it was two sacks of yarn, it was 269 euro in total. Which would be a lot more than most of our customers would spend, you know.
Yeah, that's a lot of wool.
Yeah, it's a lot of wool, and it's very, most of the Americans, when they come here, they ask, can you ship that out to us? It's too
yes,
big
yeah.
to put in our bags, because it would spend a few bob, all right. So it was a bit strange.
She was going off to knit scarves.
Knit scarves, that's exactly what she said she was going to do, yeah. I mean, knitting is still very cool. Young people love knitting scarves and hats and that type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, we young people in here all the time. So I didn't really pay much attention. I knew there was something odd, something peculiar. Her eyeshadow was a lot different than Irish girls would wear, for example, her eyeliner and her makeup, so, totally. But, she was just enjoying herself, you know.
And when did you realise it was Ariana Grande?
Yesterday.
When
I started hearing about she was in Crumlin.
Oh, she was in Crumlin.
Penny and drop came. Yeah, absolutely. Did I seem foolish or what? But having said that, had I known, I wouldn't have said anything. Had I known, I wouldn't have asked for an autograph. Had I known, I wouldn't have looked for a selfie, you know. But we get celebrities in all the time.
Like who?
Well, this is the problem, Ray. See, I'm older than you, so I don't recognise a lot of the people.
Oh, yeah.
My staff would be, the young girls would be saying to me, did you see who that was? And, you know, we'd have Fair City actresses in here all the time.
Yeah.
We'd have Mary McAleese, regular.
Right,
and she would say that when she was president, she spent her time in the back of the limousine knitting, or on the executive, the government jet.
Knitting.
Knitting. Yeah. She said, otherwise it's a waste of time. You know, you might as well do something productive. You know?
Yeah.
So I say we guess famous people, but we just, I mean, yeah, they're famous to my staff, but not famous to me.
But do you have CCTV in the shop?
We do have CCTV. Uh-huh. We do have indeed. And I've been asked this, people ask me for screen grabs and all the rest of it.
Yes.
I haven't looked back on the disc, to be honest. I mean, right, we'll get a few screen grabs put up on our own Facebook.
And how do you think they decided on your shop in particular?
Well, this is a strange one, because when Diane rang, she kept saying, the second day especially, she says, everywhere we go, they keep saying we should go to Spring Wools. Everyone says you need to go to Spring Wools. That's where you get the best yarn in Ireland, the best selection. They've got it's a huge warehouse of yarn. So I don't know who's telling her this, but obviously she passed it on to Ariande, and Ariande wanted to come, and right, that was her day's shopping.
Brilliant, 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 brilliant. I love it, I love it.
And yeah, the girls here, the girls go early on Tuesday afternoon. They are distraught. Yeah. But the strange thing was half five was very important to her. So I reckon, are you closing at half five? We'll be there at half five. I think they might have wanted to be here when our shop wasn't full of customers.
Uh-huh. You see.
But
there
see,
you go.
This is all in hindsight.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, it all makes sense, though.
Everything
it
makes
all makes sense.
Sense.
Yeah,
you know,
it
I couldn't
all makes
work
sense.
It out. I mean,
yes, yeah,
didn't want to receive, to play by credit card, you know, just, you know,
yeah,
didn't
yeah
want to know the price of anything. No. Just stock it up and ship it out, you know.
It's a great yarn, dare I say.
That is exactly what it is. Well done. Pun intended.
Right, good luck.
Good luck.
See you,
right,
Kevin. Thanks. That's Kevin Cheers. Spring from Spring Wools.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Ray O'Neill and Alison Keating join us in studio as they do once a month or so. Ray is a psychotherapist, Alison is a psychologist, and they're here to offer you advice on their on any relationship woes you may have. Hi, Alison.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Ray.
Hey, Ray.
Good to see you. Okay, so we'll start with this one then. Dear Ray and Alison, my husband often puts me down in front of others. He criticises my opinions and also corrects me. I've tried to point this out to him, but he's not very receptive, unsurprisingly, and explain how his behaviour makes me feel. It's becoming wearisome. He is very meek in front of his overpowering parents. Your advice would be welcome. Thank you, Laura. Alison.
Oof, Laura. I just think this is really awful, and it's so common that I think that's part of the problem. It's nearly like we're expected to kind of laugh. Like, you see husbands and wives or people in relationships putting each other down, and it's like the general consensus is everyone just joining, ha, 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 isn't this funny? But it actually isn't funny. You're supposed to like, never mind love, you're supposed to like the person you're in a relationship with, and it's just not okay. So I can hear that she's really tried so far to get her point across, and it's not getting across at this point. She's not going to solve the problem with his overbearing parents, and he's obviously taking that out on her. But I don't know, is there another way around this? Could they go into, would he be open? I don't know, to talking about it through therapy. But she's going to have to find another way of saying this in a very direct way, saying, I'm not actually accepting this anymore. It's not actually okay for you to speak like this to me. You wouldn't speak like this to people at work. You wouldn't speak to a friend. Do you actually like me? Because we need to start somewhere and move from that point. So I think you just have to draw very clear boundaries, and no joking, no laughing. And I think what happens is sometimes when people are saying the same thing and nothing's, you know, they're not changing the behaviour, you'd have to put down a line with it and say, if this doesn't actually change, I'm not making a threat here, but I'm just not accepting it in the relationship.
You're a psychotherapist, Ray.
Yeah.
So is the very meek in front of his overpowering parents, is that significant?
You asked the right question. The sins of the father fall on the son. Yeah. That, and in many ways, I think that's the best place to approach this. That when there's been an encounter, a confrontation with the parents, and he's feeling that kind of humility or shame or whatever it is that the overpowering parents, just saying, for Laura to say, what's going on for you now? This is how I feel. This is what happens to me. Because he's probably doing this unconsciously, because like Alison says, we're a nation of slaggers. And so too much, you know, harmful behaviour can become normalised. But the point where he will feel her pain is when he's experiencing it for himself with his parents.
Yes, yeah. And it's difficult to broach that with somebody, to suggest that maybe how his parents behave with him is affecting how he's behaving with his wife.
Exactly. Yeah. He mightn't be able to see that.
Yeah.
Which, like as Ray is saying, that is the right place to start, but you have to be able to see it yourself. Mm. So that's where these, you know, issues can become unresolved. And she just needs to say that very clearly to him. And as Ray's saying, you know, get him to empathise and to recognise who are you really angry with? This misplaced anger. You're not actually angry with me. And if you are, what is it? We need to sort it out.
Yes. But and maybe you're angry with your parents.
Yes.
Yeah. And also that, again, for any good parent to say, look, the book stops with us. We all carry our faults and shortcomings forward. But let's not create another generation in the children that may be following that they learn that this is appropriate behaviour for a man to treat a woman or a husband to treat a wife.
Yeah. Okay. I hope that works out for you, Laura. Now, dear Ian Allison, I live abroad and my boyfriend is a different religion and nationality. I told my parents last year and they reacted very badly. They have since told me that they do not wish to hear his name or know anything about him. I'm continuing to see him and travel with him, but I don't ever mention his name to my parents. They have been very unreasonable about the situation and have said some horrible things to me. I have not responded to any of this and continue to have a relationship with them, but do not speak about my boyfriend. He is due to visit Ireland in a few months for a friend's wedding and I'm worried about him coming. I don't intend on bringing him to see my parents. Any advice would be appreciated. Ray.
It's an old story because, again, we all have grown up in an Ireland where, you know, there's a division around religion between Catholics and Protestants and don't go near anyone that kicks with the other foot. And the problems that can cause within families, let's be very clear, the parents are the ones that have the problem here. They're the ones that are being bigoted. They're the ones that are being ignorant. And that shouldn't be facilitated or enabled. If you've met a good guy, celebrate that. And even though your parents will have trouble with that, and they are having, if you're accommodating their trouble, you're only going to make the trouble bigger in the long run.
Yeah. well, you know, because you want everybody to get on. I know that sounds...
But everybody doesn't get on. I know. Right? They don't.
I know, but...
Do you remember back in Walton's Mountain when everyone got on?
No, but, you know, you don't want to jeopardise the relationship with your parents.
But are they worried
about... They're bigots and all that. But you would like that they, you know, they got on with your new boyfriend. Is there anything they can do to change their mind? Is there anything she can do to change their mind?
But we only change when there's something we're going to lose. And so for her to turn around and say, look, Mum and Dad, this is now going to limit our friendship. And so I won't be as close. And if there's a huge part of my life you're shutting down, that'll only get bigger, whether it's in relation to this guy or other things. But that's your choice. You make somebody complicit in what they're doing.
If you facilitate it, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're dealing with people who aren't open-minded, and their mind is shut, and it is bigoted, and it is racist, and it's xenophobic, and all these different things. You've got to recognise when you're dealing with someone who can actually hear what you're saying. But like Ray saying, I agree. You go back to the parents and you say, this is affecting our relationship because this person, they're actually even afraid to say, they're not even telling their parents how much is upsetting them. They're taking this load on. And there's only so much of that you can push down. It's going to come out in anger or resentment towards the parents at some stage. We're hopefully talking about an adult here. So, I mean, the parents have to move out of that. We're the adults. We know best. And what's actually going on? I think going back in, like Ray's saying, having a conversation, saying, you have the potential to lose me. I don't want that. I really don't. Can we come to some level where we actually accept the difference is even that you don't like him. They don't have to like him.
Yeah.
But they don't...
They obviously don't even know him.
I know that. but that's a starting point.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, this is really not going to...
They don't
well.
Like what they think he stands for. That's what they
but
don't like.
But every LGBT person in the country understands this predicament, particularly people that grew up of an age. And Ireland has matured and parents and grandparents and children have matured because we stopped hiding love. Love is such a gorgeous thing. Mm. It shouldn't be hidden.
Yeah. Okay, now, this is a shorter one. I'm very happy in a relationship with the man of my dreams. It took a long time to find him. Everything has been amazing. However, my partner has recently broached the idea of an open relationship. I'm naturally jealous and will not cope with this.
I think this person's answered their own question.
Right.
Run!
Red
flag.
if you're not able to cope with it, then that's it.
Yeah.
You know, I think open relationships, they work when two mutual people are like, hey, this is a good idea, let's try it. And it's very open and there's, you know, boundary setting and everything works, you know, well. It's a constantly moving conversation. If you're not able to cope with it from the beginning, you know that you have issues with, you know, jealousy. It's just, it's not going to work.
Mm. Again, all I would just say there is have a conversation about why an open relationship is something he's looking at and why an open relationship is something she doesn't want, so that at least you're having conversations, because the outcome is less important at some level than the process that creates that outcome. If you're relating, you're in a relationship.
Right.
If you're deciding, then it's Boris Johnson.
Okay. I'll just bring him into the conversation. It's just so ugly. I was watching it last night. It's just so ugly, isn't it? And people are so upset. And that must be permeating down through the British public.
Absolutely.
When they're seeing their leaders behave like this.
Yeah.
Anyway, dear Ray and Alison, I love my partner dearly, but I'm finding that I am attracted to other women and thinking about what it would be like to have a sexual relationship with someone else. I am particularly attracted to my neighbour's wife. Am I a bad person?
Wow.
Well, the Bible has very strict rules on neighbours' wives.
But
as I'm not a biblical scholar, look, it's completely human to fancy other people. That's just what happens.
Yeah.
So enjoy your fantasy, but don't confuse fantasy and reality, because reality always comes with a price.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's a tricky one, because you don't know, like Ray's saying, there's the fantasy of it, but there seems to be like an intent that they would like this to happen. I mean, affairs, whether sexual or emotional at any level, you have to look at, you know, are you actually stepping outside of the relationship before you've even done something? And what's going on in your own relationship at home?
That's what we were talking to Alan de Botton yesterday, and we spoke about affairs, and that's what he was saying, that an affair starts long before sometimes you even meet the other person, because it's something to do, it's symptomatic of something wrong in your relationship. The other thing he said, which is very interesting, and I found nearly hilariously funny, was that, you know, when you get to know somebody in a relationship, you see their flaws and their weaknesses and all that sort of thing, but when you meet somebody for the first time, you know, somebody that you may have an affair with, you don't know them well enough to, you know, to know what it's going to be like.
No, they're gorgeous.
It's a fantasy. It's totally
like you don't see their knickers on the floor.
No.
You're not rowing
over
credit cards.
No.
That says a lot about our domestic lives.
They're not my smelly socks.
All of those things.
But they're perfect because you don't know them.
Yes.
Fantasies are perfect because they're not real.
Yes.
And they're not intimacy. Because intimacy is all those things.
Accepting all of those things.
And kind of nearly laughing at, God, you do the worst things, but I still love you. You know what I mean? I think that's real love.
Yeah. So I think, am I a bad person? Probably not a bad person, because most people have similar thoughts.
No, having thoughts is fine. It's what we do with our thoughts. Take responsibility for them. Don't just think that gives you permission to act on them. That's foolish and potentially dangerous.
Can't help myself.
I'm a sex addict.
No, I think it's time to kind of click back in and then look at, okay, I'm having a fantasy here. What is it about it? Is it that I want something new, different, fresh? Is that something that we should actually work on in the relationship
that's
at home?
So turn the energy into the...
Totally. Very intense, you know, you can't have that level of intensity if you're doing the same thing all the time. So look at exploring different kind of being different sexually together and having new experiences together.
Thank you very much. Neil, Alison Keating and Ray and Alison will return in about a month's time to answer your questions on relationship woes. Thanks for the moment. Mary Wilson's on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.